Shooters Touch Nation, welcome back to another episode of the Shooters Touch. We have another great head coach on our podcast today. A little bit outside of our typical geography or location, we head out west to New Mexico State University and talk to head coach Chris Jans. If you don't know much about Coach Jans, he has many Iowa ties, originally from Fairbank, went to high school at Wapsie Valley, was an assistant coach at Granby University at one time, and then made the move to head coach at Kirkwood College. A little bit of a journeyman after that, moved around to different universities, JUCOs, and colleges around the United States, actually, but ended up running into me and me running into him at Illinois State University, where he was an assistant coach under Horter Mosier for the Redbirds. Ended up as an assistant coach under Greg Marshall at Wichita. That story is very good. We dive into that into the podcast. And then obviously now head coach at New Mexico State University, multiple different NCAA tournaments, multiple different conference champions, and really fun team to watch play just because of the way they play. It was a really awesome conversation connecting the dots with Chris Jans. Used to play under our previous guest, Coach Marty McCowan, in high school. So very good friends with that family. And, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of ties here back to the area. As I mentioned, head coach Chris Jans of the New Mexico State University Aggies. We hope you enjoy it.
I got the shooter's touch. Can't nobody shoot like me. Fourth quarter down three, need a 2-and-1. Better call on me, better call on me. If you know you need a shooter, I'm ice cold like a cooler. Get you right though, I can tutor. This that mic flow, I'm a hooper. I got blue faces on blue faces.
Well, again, welcome back, Shooters. We have another great guest here on the Shooters Touch, head men's basketball coach of the New Mexico State Aggies, Coach Chris Jans. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, we're excited to take a little time here and catch up and see how things are going. Obviously, the big connection and everything that we do here are two things is around the state of Iowa and basketball. And so the three of us definitely have that going. And with that, Coach, let's talk a little bit about the beginning. What was it like for you growing up in Iowa, Fairbank area, Wapsie Valley? What was the neighborhood like? Did you get into some pickup games? And what was sports and the competitive level like for you growing up in Iowa?
Yeah, it was awesome. I wouldn't trade my childhood for anyone else's. I wouldn't. I loved growing up in Fairbank, Iowa, and being a part of the Wapsie Valley community. It was typical small town America, a lot of bike riding, a lot of scraped elbows and knees. Certainly had some pickup games, but they were more of the one-on-one, two-on-two variety. Didn't have a lot of five-on-five in the off season. You weren't that many guys that were interested in doing that. You know, most people had jobs, et cetera, outside of school, especially in the summer with the farming community, et cetera. I love where I'm from. I love going back. I'm fortunate. I'm the oldest of five, and I got, 14, 15 nephews, nieces, and all my siblings live within 15 minutes of where my parents grew up and where we grew up, for that matter. So when I go home, I get to see everybody in one swoop, and it makes it really nice for me that way, not to have to travel a ton to be able to see all of my family. And it's a little ironic that, I was the only one that actually ever left that area, but I understand why they don't leave, because it's a great community and it's a great place to raise families. And like I said, we played a lot of sports. I mean, that's all we did. Fortunately, I grew up in a sporting community. I mean, all I can remember is playing wiffle ball in the yard and, football in the biggest grassy area we could find. Being kids, and it was awesome, and I certainly wouldn't trade it for anything.
So when did basketball start to kind of take a toll as far as a love relationship with the sport for you? Was it at a young age, or did it take a little while for you?
You know, I remember is, you know, playing every sport that was offered once I get into organized sports. I mean, people would ask me what my favorite sport was, and it was always whatever was in season. So I played it all. I mean, track, golf, which I was poor at both of those. I remember my sophomore year, AAU just started taking hold in Iowa. This was back in the mid-80s. And certainly I was excited about that. You know, I got an AAU team, our conference, got some of the better players together. And, you know, we're like, you know, we're going to play an AAU team. And we did. And then my track coach came to me once and said, hey, it's a little too much. You're going to have to make a decision, a choice between running track or playing AAU. And I'm like, oh, there's no decision. I'm going to play basketball. I hated track. But, you know, it's what we did. Whatever sport was in season, that's what we did. And I hated track. I hate it. I don't understand what you get out of running around the oval. You know, and I don't want my players to hear this because, you know, we run a little bit on the side, and probably don't like that, me admitting that. But yeah, I played, I mean, every sport, like I said, football, baseball, golf. I didn't play golf to my senior year because my football coach told me, you know, he was the golf coach, and he's like, hey, Jansy, why don't you go out for golf this year? I'm like, coach, I'm awful at golf. And he's like, yeah. But, you know, nice little deal. Get out of school for a couple of days. I'm like, all right, sign me up. You know, and I would go out there. I mean, I'd be shooting in the 50s or something for 9 holes, you know. And so in terms of falling in love with basketball, you know, in Iowa at the time, I'm sure it's still the same. And you know, being from Iowa, like, Iowa is a wrestling state if it's anything. And so I wrestled since, like, the second grade all the way up to my freshman year. I went to all the kiddie tournaments. I was a better wrestler than I was anything else. Our community was wrestling based. And so all I can remember from a kid was wrestling and going to all the little towns. I'm sure I've been to your guys' hometowns and wrestling tournaments. I remember being in Ackley wrestling from second grade all the way up to my freshman year. And you have to make that decision if you're going to play basketball or wrestle once you get to high school. In junior high, you can do both, which I did. And I always knew I was going to play basketball in high school once I got in junior high. But around Wasee Valley, which was more of a wrestling school, we weren't a basketball school at all. I don't think, you know, they'd been in the NCAA tournament for decades until we went. But I remember not wanting to make the decision. Again, this wasn't a big decision, okay? It wasn't LeBron's decision. It was just me in Little Fairbank, Iowa, trying to make a decision between wrestling and basketball. But in my little world, where these wrestlers were tough dudes, you know, and it was a town of 1,000 people, so everybody knew everybody. And these guys were real friendly to me because they were recruiting the guys around the fence to wrestle instead of play basketball. And they certainly had some choice words back then for basketball players because, you know, the wrestling room was the smelliest room in the building. I mean, you could just – the sweat that just reeked out of that room wasn't pleasant. But they worked, and they were tough dudes. And I waited and waited and waited until, like, I had to make the decision, even though I knew I was going to. And then, oh, my God. I mean, I was a little weakling as a freshman, and I got picked on pretty hard, and I would avoid the junior, senior wrestlers in the hallways. Like, it was pretty ugly in my little world for about 2 weeks. I mean, the names they called me and how they treated me, and it was pretty intimidating, you know, at 14 years old. But basketball was always the one sport that I had the love for. I like I said, played them all like most young, you know, kids did, at least in my era. I'm not sure if it's the same anymore back there, but we played every sport imaginable that we could. And it was nice to be in a small town because, you know, like me, I wasn't very good at any of them, but, you know, the competition wasn't that good either. So I could make the team. I could be one of the better players. I could be a starter in all the sports and not even, you know, just being oblivious to what was out there, because that was before AAU. So we weren't traveling around and comparing ourselves to really good players. We weren't even playing the guys in Cedar Falls, Waterloo. You know, I mean, my buddies, we would we would get in a car when we were old enough and figure out someone to drive. And we'd go over to Burns and Gates Park in Waterloo when you played outside just to play against good players. We would do that in the summer. And, man, I felt like I was, you know, traveling to Chicago to play. I mean, just to go over to Waterloo Cedar Falls and play with someone outside of our little community. I mean, I look forward to those days to be able to do that. And we were so disappointed if we get over there and there wasn't a bunch of guys playing or the weather was bad. And I just remember just, we would just be so disappointed that there was no ball that day. But, you know, basketball was definitely the one sport, even though I was, like I said, a better wrestler than I was a basketball player, but it was the one sport that, that definitely had my heart for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely. It's changed a little bit here, but small town Iowa, obviously Adam and I grew up very much the same way. And so that we can definitely relate. And both Algona and Wartburg were probably more wrestling schools than basketball schools. So I'm right there with you on that and what comes with the wrestler. But hey, so one of our past guests, Marty McCowan, we had on here and talking about some of his teams, and obviously you specifically came up, and your passion and love for the game and just continuing to get better. I think he shared a story talking about how you would show up on his doorstep to break down film the day after a game and kind of go over some of the film. And so did you know at a young age that that maybe coaching this game might be something that you would do down the road?
You know, when I was growing up, my idols were the gym teachers at my junior high and high school. I thought they had it whipped. I thought they had the best jobs in the world. Because again, I wasn't a kid. We didn't travel much. You know, our idea of vacation is going to the Mississippi River, right? And doing stuff like that. I mean, I can probably count on one hand how many times I left the state when I was in high school. And it was, you know, either vacation with the family, you know, load up the station wagon and go to Colorado and see the mountains, you know. Other than that, you know, it just wasn't exposed to the world or what was out there. And I didn't know any better, which is awesome because I had everything to look forward to, even though I didn't realize that. But I thought the PE teachers / coaches, all I could say is if I could do that, I would just be thrilled to death. So that's really what I wanted to be, you know. And then my dad and my mom, but my dad specifically, you know, didn't have the opportunity to go to college, et cetera. And so they were all about, you know, trying to get me to think that way and go to college. And you know, back then, even to this day, I know teachers are underappreciated and underpaid. And certainly back then, you know, they were. And so they kind of got me off that mindset. You know, hey, go to college, you know, get into a different field, et cetera. And so, you know, I did like most good sons do and listened to my dad and kind of got out of that mindset and went to college and got degrees and a couple of degrees, one in marketing and one in finance. And they must have been giving them away back then at Laurel Oaks because my professors are rolling their eyes right now. But, you know, got a couple of degrees and was ready to attack Wall Street. And that was kind of my mentality. And but, you know, didn't have any connections, didn't really know how to get my foot in the door. And then basically in the back of my mind, I'm like, I want to coach, you know. And so probably would have been better if I would have thought like that, you know, through my college career and made connections. But that was the furthest thing from my mind. So literally had to start from scratch. And my first year out of college, I did not coach. I held odd jobs. Different places. And then I made the big decision. I was going to be a manager trainee for Sherwin Williams Paint Store. So I went through the training program, was based out of Cedar Falls, Waterloo for a while. Then I got my big break and I got my assistant manager spot at Mason City, Iowa. And I lived up there in Nyack country in a one bedroom efficiency for a few months. And one day I'm like, okay, this ain't gonna work, and just basically resigned and chased coaching back. It was in the spring after my senior year, and then you know, finally made a connection with a coach at Elmhurst College in Chicago, and I think I was the fifth assistant at Division III program my first year. I was the last guy in the totem pole. And you want to talk about, you know, starting from the bottom and all that stuff. I mean, I don't think you can start much lower in college, than I did.
Well, before, and Adam's going to, we're going to lead, that's a perfect lead up into your, how you got into coaching. But before we transition to that real quick, just because you mentioned it, we got to know a little bit about Loris and your time as a Duhawk and in Dubuque. What was that like for you? So you didn't do any coaching or didn't have that in the forefront. But what was your time like in Dubuque?
You know, it was a great place to go to school. It was a fun college town. You know, you had three colleges in a fairly smaller town. You know, you got Clark College, University of Dubuque, and Loris, all in a very close proximity, which is kind of odd. But it was great. Loved my experience there, both off the floor, on the floor. I was close to home. You know, hour and a half drive down Highway 20. I could get home, you know, for a weekend or for a day, and my parents and family could come watch us play. Obviously, we were a member of the Iowa Conference, so we'd get home and you know, play the schools in and around where I was from. So that was really cool. And you know, basketball wise, I didn't realize it because again, I wasn't thinking about being a coach, but the coaches I played for, I was very fortunate. I mean, I played for some tough guys. I played for some knowledgeable guys. My first year, you know, my head coach was Mike Jaskolski. Steve Craftison actually recruited me. He was at Loris as an assistant, and I love Coach K. He's the best. And he recruited me and then left, and I think he went to Iowa State. He was on the men's side then. I was obviously with the women at DMAC, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. Mike Jaskolski was my coach, and then he left after my first year to go be a Division I assistant somewhere. And then they had a young guy on staff named Brad Soderberg, who had played for Dick Bennett in college. And so Brad Soderberg was, I don't know, mid-late 20s, 26, 27, maybe 28. And a first year college coach, and had played for Dick Bennett. And so you can imagine, you know, how tight we were. I mean, I think we passed the ball seven or eight times before we looked at the basket. I mean, you weren't taking a shot unless it was a layup before the mover blocker and the old school motion. And I mean, we defended and we did one-on-one and two-on-two breakdown drills so the cows came home. And, you know, I didn't know any better. I mean, I love Marty McCowan, and he's a friend of mine to this day. But when Marty coached me at Wapsie, he was straight out of football. He was straight out Upper Iowa. He was 22 years old. I was 14, and he didn't have a ton of knowledge about basketball when he first started. And I'm sure he'd be the first to admit, how could he? He didn't play college basketball. He's playing football and baseball and worrying about his own game, coaching someone else. And so he came straight from Upper Iowa to coach us, which we could talk about that forever. I got some great stories when it comes to that, I promise you. I don't know what he said on his podcast, but I could set the record straight if you want me to. But anyway, well, I digress. So playing for Coach Soderberg wasn't enjoyable. It was tough. You know, he was obviously a really good coach. And what he coached what he knew. He knew Dick Bennett. And Dick Bennett was obviously a disciplined coach, a tough coach, a no-nonsense coach. So that's what I knew. And then fortunately, between my junior and senior year, we had a big class ahead of me where a lot of my friends were. And they had a bunch of seniors, and they graduated. And so going into my senior year, you know, in Division III, I don't know how it is now, but they used to bring in 20 guys in a class, right? They need to get enrollment up, et cetera, JV team. So by the time I got to be a senior, there were only two of us left. Okay, me and another guy named Gary Heilers. And he wasn't much of a scorer. He was an athlete, runner, jumper. And so Brad Soderberg wrote me a letter. I still have it somewhere. And I pinned it up in my bedroom between my junior and senior year about we're going to open the offense up. We're gonna you need to work on your game, be in great shape. We're gonna play as many minutes as you can, shoot as many shots as you can. And I'm like, oh, I mean, I think I framed it, and I was always gonna make sure to remind him that he sent me this letter in the summer, you know, because I was so excited to go into my senior year, like they're gonna take the gloves off and we're gonna score, we're gonna shoot. And so I went from averaging like 11 points a game as a junior to 28 as a senior. And I hate to tell, I hope Coach will never, he will never listen to this, but I didn't work on my game that much between my junior and senior year. Okay. I really didn't. So I didn't get that much better. He just opened up the offense. He changed styles because he had to adapt. We didn't have a bunch of good players back. And for me, in a selfish way, it was like heaven on earth. I mean, I could run the right wing, and the whole goal was to get me the ball and me shoot it as many times as I could. So I broke a ton of records that year, but I also broke a ton of attempt records. I mean, I guarantee I shot that thing every time down the court. It was like a shooter's dream. You know, it was awesome. I didn't play that much defense my senior year. My first 3 years, I had to get on the court, but I kind of had him because I knew he needed me to score, and I was one of the lone upperclassmen that could get it done. So college was awesome. You know, another thing I wouldn't trade for much. Some of my best friends are still guys that I met in college and in some in high school, but it certainly was a good experience. And getting back to my original story is I didn't realize it, but it helped me so much in my early years of coaching because that's what I knew. You know, I knew from what the college guys taught me, my coaches taught me, and I had a great base at a young age in terms of fundamentals defensively, how to run a program, how to run a practice, how to discipline your team. And I didn't realize it at the time, but they were preparing me, you know, to be a coach.
Well, that's an awesome story. And I don't know about you, Brian, but I mean, sign me up for your senior year, coach. That sounds, like you said, kind of like heaven on a basketball court.
I mean, I averaged 28 points a game. I mean, I don't pay attention to it, but at the time, I was the record holder for most threes made per game at any level. I mean, I was making, you know, I made 10 threes a couple times. Average was like 5 points something. But again, I'm not going to, you know, the other side of the coin is I shot it up. Ton. Yeah. I remember playing against UD 1 year. They came out and Coach Davidson, who I really love to this day, he was a coach at UD. He was a coach at Clark recently. Great guy. And they boxed and won my point guard. I was the two guard. I'm like, hey, hold up. I'm the guy. I'm the one scoring all the points. And they boxed and won him, which was a really good move because he was the guy getting the outlets and spraying the ball up the court. You know, and so here I am wide open. And I shot 24 threes in one game, okay, against our rival, and I only made 8. I was, like, just so frustrated. I remember, like, I'd miss it and be like, how did I miss so open? And I kept missing it, and they kept leaving me open. I'm like, what is going on? You know, and fortunately, I don't think, you know, film was prevalent back then because other teams probably should have done that because I struggled when I was open. But 24 threes in one game. I just can't imagine one of my players shooting 24 threes, only making 8 of them, and me continuing to encourage them to shoot the ball. But yeah, it was heaven on earth, Adam. You know, guys like you, you would have been in heaven, no doubt about it.
Sounds phenomenal to me, that's for sure. Let's jump into your coaching career, Coach. You mentioned that, you know, you got your first coaching gig about a year after you graduated college. I guess specifically here to Iowa, assistant at Grandview. And then it was your first head coaching job at Kirkwood?
It was. I got very lucky. You know, I didn't probably deserve the job. I hadn't done anything in the business. I was 2 years at Elmer's, low man in the totem pole, and then a couple years at Grandview. As assistant coach, and you know, but I didn't make any money. I mean, my job was the dorm director for the men, and then I had to bring in like student activities coordinator. I would bring in acts on campus, and I had all sorts of titles when I was at Grandview. I mean, even at Kirkwood, I was 7 years in the business before all I did was basketball. Like, that's what people don't get at that level. When you start, you're not getting paid to be a coach. You're getting, you know, that's the reason you're there. But if you want to earn the money and the insurance, you got to do other things. And Kirkwood was the first head coaching job. And, you know, like I alluded to earlier, I was fortunate who I had played for, because if it wasn't for that, you know, I probably would have really struggled as a young head coach. But someone gave me the acronym, which is widely, you know, everybody knows it, you know, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And that's what I did. You know, I didn't try to reinvent the wheel. I just tried to get my teams to play really, really hard. And we ran motion offense and we ran man-to-man defense. And that's all we did. And, you know, had some success there. And that kind of jump-started, you know, the career. Because up until that point, you know, like I said, we Granby, we didn't win a ton. We weren't, you know, like a championship program, et cetera. And Elmhurst, you know, same way. So I had a personal connection to the leadership at Kirkwood. Another Iowa, some Iowa guys. The only reason I really got the interview was my AD at Loras, Bob Berry, who was also the football coach. I had a relationship with him when I was a student athlete. He wanted me to play football at Loras, which I never would, because I'm like, no, my basketball coach will kill me if I play football. So I'm going to stick with it. But he always, every year he'd get on me behind the scenes about, hey, we need another cornerback, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I wouldn't do it, but we had a mutual respect for one another and still to this day. But Lon Olenzak, former Iowa Hawkeye, which is way before your time, you know, he was a Rose Bowl participant, I think, back in the day for when, you know, for Iowa and the Swarm and all that. He was in the leadership committee, and he refereed Iowa conference football games on the side. And he had a lot of respect for Bob Berry. So I had Bob Berry call Lon Olenzak, and that's the only reason Lon Olenzak told me the story after I got hired, that they even taught, they didn't know who I was. I'm an assistant at Grandview College, you know, for 2 years. And you know, that connection got me in the door, and, you know, I must have lied to him enough for them to give me the job at that age, but it all worked out.
Yeah, it looks like in two seasons, though, it looks 25-10 and 31-6. So you definitely had some success at Kirkwood, and obviously that program has continued to have success and have some good coaches come through there. But after that, then it looks like you transitioned down to Kansas, Independence Community College down there in Kansas. I'd like to talk just a little bit about this. Independence would have been something probably 2 years ago. I would have had no idea what it was, but obviously since The Last Chance U has gone through there, did you get an opportunity to watch on Netflix that docuseries with Coach Brown and the football program at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That was wild. That was wild. You know, obviously that was way after my time. I was there for one season back in, oh, it would have been 98, 99. But, you know, for me, growing up in Fairbank, not having, parents or aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters that were into college basketball or were, knowledgeable of it, I didn't know the business at all. I mean, I didn't know it at all. When I stepped foot on Elmhurst campus, I didn't know what I was getting into. And, you know, just like everything in life, the more experience you get, the more knowledge you get, the more understanding you get. But as I got into the business, the Jayhawk Conference in junior college was one of the premier conferences in the country, especially back then. I mean, there are tons of pros that have been going through there in the 80s and the 90s. So to have the opportunity to coach in that league, I was just giddy about, at the time. But certainly we had a football program then, but nothing like, you know, they had with Coach Brown and the crew that he had. And, I just remember watching that going, I don't think there's any way that I would ever allow a TV camera into my program, especially back then. I mean, that's just me. It was entertaining. It was made for great TV. I'm glad I wasn't a part of that. Let's just put it that way.
Well, with your time there, was that something, was it at all like that where you guys were kind of almost a feeder program or trying to get those kids, you know, over to Kansas, or what was it like? I know you're only there for a year, so you really didn't spend a lot of time, but was that kind of the idea behind the conference as a whole?
No, that's a little overrated aspect of junior college. I'm a JUCO guy in our business. You know, I coached JUCO for four different JUCOs, all being a head coach. And there's a myth that, you know, these junior college programs are there to feed certain schools. And in my experience to this day, you know, 28 years in college basketball, that's not really the case. Those coaches, for the most part, they're just worried about winning. They're trying to win. They're trying to win championships. They're trying to, most of them are trying to move up the chain, if you will. Not all of them, but most of them have higher aspirations. And it's a great way to cut your teeth without the spotlight and you know, learn from your mistakes and learn how to run a program, but not having to do it on ESPN or have, every little thing you do wrong magnified, you know, like at the Division I level. So I'm a big advocate for that level. Certainly there's strengths and weaknesses of going up the Division I rank or Division II or even Division III that matter compared to junior college. But the experience that you get and the hands-on that you get in every aspect of the program at that level, because at our level, you know, like I look out my office and I got 7 or 8 guys out there and I'm like, what in the hell do you guys do all day long? Like, I don't even know what they do all day long. Like, it's just, it's crazy at our level how many staff members we have. It's ridiculous in my opinion, but, you know, it is what it is. And but at that level, you'll be lucky if you got a couple guys, you know, with you. And so you get to do, you get to, and you have to do everything. So you learn, what the program's like and what's important and et cetera, et cetera. So certainly part of your responsibility as a junior college coach is to get your guys to mature as people, to graduate them, and to help them along in the process to make their decision of where they're going to be a four-year player. And you know, a lot of them go Division I, some go NAIA, Division II, what have you. But in terms of certain schools, you know, feeding kids, I mean, that's not really the case. Once in a while, a kid will get placed with you, and it's your job to make sure he goes back to that particular school. But that changes too. I mean, you know, kids change their mind. You know, maybe they play up a level, maybe they play down a level. And at the end of the day, certainly relationships come into play. You know, the relationships that you have with other people in the business, colleagues of yours, et cetera, you know, that maybe you can help influence their decision. But at the end of the day, you know, those kids and their mentors and families are going to make the decision on where they want to, you know, pursue their career.
Awesome. Awesome. Obviously, there's a couple, you know, other places that you've coached out here, Coach, but let's just maybe let's maybe speed ahead here a little bit where I guess you and I first came into contact on the basketball court would be the Missouri Valley and your time at Illinois State. So walk us through and tell us a little bit about your time in Bloomington Normal.
Yeah, if we went through every stop, this would be like a 3-hour deal. We can't do that. You know, the blueprint I went through to get where I'm at is, I wouldn't advise that for any young person trying to be a coach, but it's my history and I love it, and I wouldn't trade it for the world, because there's a lot of positives to it. But Illinois State, let's see. I wish I could go back, and I'm getting better as the older I get of getting rid of stuff. You know, when you move as much as I do, it's the best time to kind of cleanse and get rid of stuff. But there for a while, I used to have just huge file cabinets of everywhere I've been, of every scouting report, every clinic, you know, and I'm just like, okay, this is too much clutter. And so I've moved a ton. So we've decluttered recently as I've gotten older, but I wish I could go back and find the scouting report on you so I could read it right now, you know, and talk about, I'm sure you weren't a very good defender. I just can't imagine you were a very good defender. I'm sure you were a catch and shoot guy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it wasn't, the scouting report on me probably wasn't very long. Catch and shoot, maybe dribble every once in a while.
But you're on the back page.
Definitely not a good defender. That's 100%.
Yeah, I wish I could find that, because what's funny is when I was at Wichita State back in the day, we played New Mexico State twice, and it wasn't that big a gap between me being there and then coming here. And I had some scouting reports of some of the players that I was coaching. But unfortunately, I didn't find them. I just came upon them because I just moved recently in town in Las Cruces. And I came upon them, and oh my God, I took pictures of them. And I brought them to the office and I showed the staff. And I'm like, oh, I wish so-and-so was still here. I could have showed him. I knew his game a long time ago, and I was right. You know, he wasn't a good defender, you know, or he couldn't score in traffic. And, oh, we got the biggest kick out of that when I brought them to the office with my staff that were here coaching those young men. But, again, you know, I wish I could have brought that to the table today. We could have had some fun with that for sure. I should have been more diligent with my preparation and found a scouting report with maybe one of my colleagues from back in the day. But, yeah, you know, grew up around Missouri Valley, so having the opportunity to be in the Missouri Valley, not just Illinois State, but at Wichita State for as long as I was. And I was there, you know, in the heyday, if you will. I mean, you know, we were there when we were getting 4 bids. You know, it was a multi-bid league, and we had, you know, teams that were winning games in the NCAA tournament. Making runs, and you know, there's nothing like being in a league where you don't necessarily have to win the conference tournament to get in. And that's a fun time to be in those leagues when it's happening, because, you know, there's so much to play for in every game. And, you know, I just remember the league being such a coaches league. You know, there weren't a ton of NBA players coming through the league. You know, it wasn't a league that was, you know, extremely high in athleticism, but it was high in you know, coaching acumen. It was high in tough kids, you know, the guys that could make baskets, obviously, really shoot the cover off the ball. And I'm not trying to downplay it when I say it wasn't like an NBA league or a high-level athletic league. There's plenty of athletes in the league, but just different, you know, from maybe some other leagues that I've coached in or scouted against, et cetera. And, you know, to be in the league for as long as I was and to be in it when, you know, it was in its, I won't say heyday. I mean, you can go back for decades when it was unbelievable. I mean, New Mexico State was in the Valley back in the day, and there's a lot of teams that were in the Valley back in the day and rivalries and great programs. But my experience was kind of cool just to be in it when we were getting 3-4 teams in for a period of time.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously I remember that, you know, the trips over to Bloomington Normal playing Redbird Arena. You know, one of the largest in the Missouri Valley. That place got loud with Osiris Eldridge was there. I think Levi Dyer was a big foreman for you guys, who was very good. But, you know, yeah, I mean, that year we got 3 or 4 teams in, where we, you know, had a couple teams win a couple games. That was a fun time to be in there. And you're definitely right. I mean, a coach's league. I mean, obviously, you know, you coached with as Porter Moser, who was there for a while. And then, you know, as we talked about before we jumped on, had an opportunity to go to another school, Loyola, and went to the Final Four. I mean, that's just you know, how good that league was. And then after Illinois State made the jump over to Wichita, what was that kind of transition like? Was that something that had to happen after Porter left, or was that, you know, your choice to do that?
No, you know, when Porter got let go at Illinois State, you know, if you look back, it was, you know, it was probably the best thing that happened to all of us. Certainly at the time, didn't feel like that. But when the head coach, you know, gets let go, then obviously, you know, the staff goes with him, you know, usually. For the most part, very rarely do, you know, people get to stay on with the new head coach. But, you know, Porter went on to work for Rick Majerus at St. Louis and, you know, really helped his career. And obviously he's doing great at Loyola, and one of the better teams, you know, since he's got his guys in there and since they became a member of the conference and had the great run to the Final Four. And if you look back to when we were in that league, I mean, Mark Turgeon's at Maryland now and Dana Altman, you know, Creighton was at Oregon, and obviously Greg McDermott and Ben Jacobson are two awesome guys and coaches, and, you know, they've been a part of the league forever, with you and I and Creighton, and obviously Creighton not being in it anymore. So, but in terms of the transition to Wichita State, like, it couldn't work out any better. You know, obviously, you know, people that are familiar with Valley basketball and the Shockers, I mean, 10,506 every night. And unfortunately for us, you and I always gave us some problems, I have to admit, for some reason. But we were really hard to beat. You know, I'd been over there as a visiting coach and, you know, played there 3 times when I was with the Redbirds. And I just you're excited to play there because you know the crowd's going to be awesome. It's going to be hard to win. But it's a lot more fun to be on the bench with the black and gold when you're playing in Coke Arena, because those fans are unbelievable and rabid and committed. And it's just a great college venue. And to spend, you know, 9 years there is some memories that I'll cherish forever. And, you know, how I got hooked up with Greg Marshall is interesting. Is in 1998, we won the national championship at Kirkwood. And we were in Danville playing. And a bunch of D2, D1 assistants were there recruiting. Well, there's a D2 head coach named Jeff Reynolds, who ended up being the Air Force coach one day. we kind of saddled up in the hospitality room and got to know each other and blah, blah, blah. And he stayed the whole week. And at the end, he goes, hey, you want to be a D1 guy one day? I'm like, yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't know. I was 28 years old. Again, I didn't know the business. I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, my buddy, Greg Marshall, who played for me back in the day, is about to get the Winthrop job. I think he'd be great for him. I'm like, okay. So one thing led to another, and I flew out to Winthrop, and Coach Marshall offered me the job, and I had already interviewed at Independence Junior College. So I chose Independence and not Winthrop. Okay. And then fast forward 9 years later, I went from, you know, there to, you know, four or five of the schools, and he stayed at Winthrop for 9 years and went to the NCAA tournament 7 times. That wasn't a very good decision I made. I had to call him every spring. Hey coach, congratulations on another ring. You know, I'm up at Idaho now, blah, 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 you know? And, so during that time, from the time I went to Independence and he was at Winthrop for 9 years, I stayed in touch with him and helped him out in recruiting a couple times. A guy that played for me that you guys will know, Dana Ford at Illinois State, who's now the head coach at Missouri State, was an aspiring coach. And I thought he was really good and was going to be a great coach. And I recommended him as a GA at Winthrop. And Coach Marshall ended up hiring him as a GA at Winthrop. And it was his last year at Winthrop. And then he came to Wichita State with Dana. And then I think because he liked Dana so much and et cetera, and he wasn't a Midwest guy, it really helped me, my chances of getting on as a full-time guy at Wichita State. So I was reunited with Dana and our staff there in my first year. So, you know, on the rubber chicken circuit, when I got back to Wichita with him, you know, he would always ding me, you know, at the speaking engagements, like, yeah, you know, Winthrop wasn't good enough for James. I had to, you know, get to Wichita State before he would, you know, come with me, and, you know, and I'd have to take the heat, you know, and he might have, you know, talked about his rings a few times in our tenure there before we started getting at Wichita State. So he could, you know, he had to be quiet about that since I was, you know, got some rings as well with him. But yeah, that's I didn't know Greg Marshall from a hole in the wall in 1998. And then, was, you know, that's how the business works, is make some networks and make some relationships and build your network. And you know, you never know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, you mentioned Coke Arena. And I will tell people, I tell people this all the time, that that is the loudest arena that I've ever played basketball in. We had a game there. It would have been maybe even my senior year, so you might have been there. But it was broadcast overseas in Afghanistan. And it was, you know, whatever, a minute before a game started, and the announcer yelled at everybody to be as loud as you can for the soldiers overseas. And if I was, I mean, if I remember correctly, the first minute or two was a little bit tough to hear after that because it was so loud. And that's, you know, honestly, in Wichita, Kansas, the loudest arena I've ever been in. It was wild there.
Did we win that game or did you win?
We won that game.
Yeah, I don't remember it. I don't remember the one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a special place. It's a special place, and it's just hard to go in there as a competitor, as a visiting team.
Yes.
When they're good, which they've been good for a long, long time, and to win. But like I said, you and I had always given us some problems over there. I think after you left, we got a better handle on you and I, and they weren't quite as successful as maybe that they were in your tenure. But we had some great games against those guys for sure.
The heyday at Wichita State, that's what it was.
I was going to say, was that was that Adam leaving, or was that Wichita State getting better? Which one was it?
Well, it depends on who you ask, probably. We should ask Jacobson. We should ask Jake what he thinks.
There we go. Well, Coach, let's transition to a little bit ahead here to New Mexico State. Been there for 3 seasons. Had a lot of success here, and success early. It's kind of something that as I go through and, like you said, follow your path here, You've had success early in a lot of the programs and where you are, whether it's 1, 2, 3 years. And so I guess one of my main questions before we talk specifically about this Aggies team is, What's one thing that you try to always instill to try to build the culture to create buy-in, whether the plans is to be there for 10 years or whether it's a 2 or 3 year step? What is it that you've been able to instill in your programs to be able to have such success so early and so quickly?
You know, I'm not a paper guy. You know, I don't have a master plan written down. I just don't. I'm just not built that way for whatever reason. Sometimes I wish I was, but I'm not. We're not a slogan team. You know, we don't have a bunch of slogans in and around our program, which is kind of in vogue right now. I always tell our guys, I want people that watch us play know what we stand for. You know, I think you get a pretty good idea when you watch college teams compete, you know, what they're about and how they approach their practice, et cetera. So I would think it starts with just accountability, you know, from the top down. Everybody, you know, having a hard hat mentality and everybody having a expectation to do your job, if you will. And you know, we try to keep it pretty simple that way. And, you know, it starts with me and it bleeds into the staff and certainly the players. And, you know, once you've established yourself, you know, then it just happens. You know, the new guys come in and real quick, you know, they see it with their eyes. They hear about it in the process, but once they get there and they're part of it, they just see what it's like. And you guys have both played college basketball and you can understand what I'm saying. And there's good cultures and bad cultures. And, you know, if you got a good one, it's fun to be a part of. It's fun to be a part of. Establishing it can be hard and arduous and difficult. You know, especially when you take over a program that's won. It's a lot easier. I've done this most of my life. I've been a head coach for 6 different programs at different levels. And most of the programs I took over have lost. And so it's easy because if they want to win, they're going to listen to the new guy, at least give them a chance if they want to win at all. You know, but when you take over a program that's won at a pretty high level and then you're going to do it different, that was difficult when I first got here. I don't think I've ever felt more internal pressure when I arrived here. They're coming off a school record, 28 wins. You know, they've been going to the NCAA tournament. And the way the previous staff did it is 180 from how we do it. And, you know, again, the longer I'm in the business, the more I'm with and understand and agree with. There's a lot of different ways to get it done. You know, when I was a young coach, it was, this is the way you did it. How could you coach any other way? But with experience, because you can't teach experience, you realize that there's a lot of different ways to get it done. But that was hard. That was hard that first year. Fortunately, you know, we ended up having a good year and kind of took the pressure off. Certainly, as most head coaches will tell you, or hopefully they'll admit, I mean, you're always, you know, that pressure you feel from the outside is nothing like the pressure you feel from the inside. I mean, you know, that stuff is nothing. I mean, it's just the intensity of that to me is irrelevant compared to you know, how your insides feel and how much internal pressure you put on yourself to be successful and to win and to do it the right way. But the first year was the hardest. And then after that, it's just fun to hear the other guys lead, to hear the other guys use the terminology and the phrases that they've heard from other coaches, and now they're using it with the young players. And I don't have to get on them nearly as much. I don't have to raise my voice nearly as much. You know, obviously I'm aging a lot. I got gray everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's slowed down a little bit in the last year or two because of having a culture and establishing ourselves. So we're excited. I'm as excited now going into my fourth year as I was in my first year. But things are going well. We like where we're at. Certainly, you know what everyone's going through, not just in college basketball, but, you know, abroad with the COVID and the pandemic and how it's turned our lives upside down. Certainly, you know, we're getting better at it. You know, hopefully it'll continue to get better for everybody. I'm just glad that, you know, we have a goal in sight. You know, there's a date now, and the kids can focus a little bit harder. The coaches can focus a little bit harder. Hopefully we'll get to that point and things will even be better now in terms of testing and mitigation, et cetera, versus this awful, awful virus.
Yeah, we're right there with you. We hope that we can start to get things maybe a little bit back to normal here soon as everything's safe and able. But for those that maybe don't know a lot about, two questions actually with this. So those that don't know a lot about your program, if they were to turn on a New Mexico State game, what are some things that they can, one, expect to see as far as a little bit about on your guys' style of play? And then two, kind of transition that into this year and what you're looking forward to this year. It looks like you have a bunch of upperclassmen, so some guys with some experience. Like you said, 16-0 in the conference last year. It looks like three conference titles in a row. So obviously hoping for good things again this year. But when we catch you this year in action, what can we expect to see from the squad?
I'm not great at this. I think other coaches are probably better served to answer questions, but our staples, what we're trying to do is the things we talk about daily and the things that we focus on are defending, rebounding, and just playing really, really hard. I think if you do those three things, you're always going to have a chance. It's not like we're not coaching offense or skill development. We're huge into skill development. We do it, every day, regardless of what portion of the season we're in. But we start on that end of the floor. Analytics now have taken over basketball, and I don't follow football that closely, but I'm sure it's the same for their sport and baseball, et cetera. And that plays a part in it. And if you look at our defending and rebounding numbers, I mean, they're surprising because they're pretty good. But at the same time, that's what we focus on, are those facets of the game. It's an old school, slogan or phrase, but I still abide by it. I just think that defense travels. You get on the bus or the plane and you go to these tough arenas to play in. It's just human nature. Sometimes the ball doesn't go in the net at quite the same clip when you're on the road as you do at home with the friendly confines, et cetera. And so just makes sense to me that to be good in those facets of the game where rebounding defense should have nothing to do with, offense in terms of shooting percentage, comfort level, the distractions of being on the road are real. And so that's kind of what we live by around here. And don't get me wrong, like we feel really good about our offense. We try to score off our defense and get deflections and get advantage opportunities as best we can. But the older I've gotten and the more exposure I've gotten as a coach, I've focused, in the offseason, I don't focus on our defense. I watch all our offense. That's all I watch is our offense. And we're tweaking our offense way more than we're tweaking our defense. And we're trying to find ways to get better and to be more efficient on that end of the court every year while not giving in or lessening what we're doing in the other facets of the game that have been our staples and have been what people probably think about us if you look at the rebounding numbers and the defensive numbers that we put together. And at the end of the day, I mean, I think when people watch this, if they're knowledgeable at all, they're going to see that we compete. We try to compete all the time and try to really get after it and not give anything up easy. And then on the offensive end, try to just, space the floor and put our guys in positions where they can make plays and be athletic. And we try to recruit athletic guys. At the end of the day, it's not a joystick. You got to get these guys out there and let them play. And I like them to feel real confident on the offensive end. I don't like to put a ton of restrictions on them and try to control them. I want them to feel good. I don't want that little man in the back of his head, questioning whether this is a good shot or not. Back in the day, I wasn't raised that way in basketball. It was turn a good shot into a great shot. But I'm more like, let's get a shot. We can rebound a missed shot. We can't rebound a turnover. And, I hate it when the shot clock expires. And I try to sell them the freedom that we give them offensively in return of, how hard you're going to have to play on the other end and how focused you're going to be on defense. And if you're not willing to stick your nose in there and bang around and block people out and, and, you know, get dirty, et cetera, then you're going to have a hard time getting in the game. You know, that's your price of admission, is doing the things that we expect you to do around here. And obviously it's working thus far, and, you know, hopefully they'll continue.
Awesome. Awesome. And I know that I can probably speak for Brian too, but I really, really enjoy watching you and your team out there competing, you know, not just in the NCAA tournament, but, you know, whenever I can catch a game out there West, you know, really, really fun to watch your kids out there and play. Well, we liked in our podcast here, Coach, with a little section we call Rapid Fire. And as we kind of talked about, you'll get a couple questions from Brian, and all you really got to do is answer them.
Yeah, let's have a little fun, Coach. All right. So you coached at a lot of different levels, but who was the best player that you've ever coached against, or maybe who was just ahead of everybody else based off the level? But take it however you want. But who was the best player you've ever coached against?
Good question. 28 years, you've coached against a lot of good players. But the one that sticks out to me is Kawhi Leonard. Played against Kawhi Leonard when I was at Wichita and he was at San Diego State. And I'll never forget it. I knew one of the assistants who's now the head coach, Brian Dutcher, and we're in warm-ups, and I'm watching him warm up, and I've never seen anyone's hands bigger than that. Like, he had the biggest hands on any human being I've ever seen in my life. And I remember asking Dutch, I'm like, dude, what's up with his hands, man? Like, he's like, the only hands I've ever seen like that were Chris Webber's. Obviously, Chris Webber was a pretty good player. But yeah, he was, you could tell. I mean, obviously, he wasn't the MVP back at San Diego State of the NBA, but you could just, the talent in the body and the hands, and you could tell he's going to be a heck of a player.
Yeah, that's how he got the nickname the Claw, too, right? It makes a lot of sense.
They're big, they're huge.
Heck of a player too. Obviously, came a long ways. But what about favorite gym? Again, you can take this however you want. Going all the way back, you've been in a lot of them. What's your favorite gym?
Oh wow. I like the Loras College Fieldhouse. That's as close to Hoosiers as I've ever played in. Yep. You know, you had the track up top. You had the tartan floor, which isn't old school. It would have been nice if it had been wood floor, but it was old school tartan floor. You had the track up above, and if you would shoot a corner three, even for the home team, as you're getting ready to shoot it, okay, and I wasn't a perfect shooter. I would follow the ball. I'm sure Veet kept his eyes on the rim, but I didn't. I would follow the ball, and you'd look up and think, oh, am I going to hit the track? Am I going to hit, you know, the cement that goes around the railing? And it was there, and you could see it. But just, I mean, what a place to play, you know, because I don't know what it would probably hold 1,000 people, you know, if the fire code allowed it. You know, there wasn't much bleachers, there wasn't much room. But when you get, you know, that many people, it was tiny. Well, I went back there, I don't know, I've been back there, but last time I went back, the new arena had been built, and I was with some family members, and we went to the field house. Was open. Like, it was unbelievable. It was open. We walked in there, and there was a ball in there. And my family and I got a, you know, that's where I played, blah, 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 blah. And like, it looked really small then. I mean, you get a little bit older, and now you played in these big, humongous arenas, and, you know, you play in front of 70,000 people. And then you go back there, and you're like, wow. But at the time, you know, I thought it was, you know, as big and better as any other arena I played in, but I'd have to go with the Loras College Fieldhouse.
That's a good one, and I know exactly what you mean. That track felt like it was hanging over top of your head, and you had the suspension wires and stuff. There's a lot going on, but it was a fun place to play. Okay,
it was a home court advantage.
What's that?
Yeah. It was a home court advantage.
Oh, it was absolutely. It was. All right, have a little fun here, Coach. What's a must-have snack that you got to take with you on a road trip?
Breakfast bars, like those Belvedas. Mm-hmm. Belveda breakfast bars.
Good choice.
My wife stuffs me with those every time I leave the house. Almost on a daily, because I tend to not eat great I try to eat well, but I don't eat often as much as, and then I get hangry. I'm a hangry guy big time. I mean, I know it, and sometimes the time gets away from you, you know, and so those bars have come in handy many times.
Yeah, good, good. That's a good one. Who's the greatest player of all time?
Oh, come on, man. I mean, Michael Jordan, it's not even close. I mean,
love it.
I just don't know how anyone can argue that. But obviously, you know, the young people that have never, you know, experienced MJ and his competitive spirit and his will to win and all that. And don't get me wrong. I mean, you got to have LeBron James and Kobe in the conversation, and they deserve to be. But it's just that competitive drive and how he did it. I just can't imagine anyone else being like that.
Did you get a chance to watch The Last Dance?
Oh, absolutely. I'll keep this real short, but my first 2 years in coaching was at Elmhurst, and they just happened to be the host school for Michael Jordan's basketball camps in the summer. So
awesome.
Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, BJ Armstrong, Iowa Hawkeye, all would hold their camps at Elmhurst College in the summer. And so being the assistant coach, well, whatever they called me back then, I got to be in close quarters with him. Like, I was in office space with him multiple times. I went to play racquetball with BJ Armstrong. They would play pickup at night and I'd be right there. So it was really cool. Got to know, in The Last Dance, his driver, the guy with the hair, George Kohler, you know, he was hanging out with us at night, going to lunch and dinners with him. And, you know, I got tons of autographed stuff, balls, hats, Sports Illustrates, you know, because I had access to them. And so I got tons of stuff autographed. And I still have it to this day. Like when The Last Dance came out, I know there was a big surge in memorabilia for him and they were going for big money. And of course, I'm like, told my wife, we should. She's like, no way, you're not doing that, you know. So I lost that battle, but yeah, I mean, he's. I still talk about him with our guys. You know, we talk about him with our guys. I argue with them. It's kind of fun to get into it with those guys a little bit because none of those guys are going to choose him.
Yeah, no. Well, we're in agreement with you there, so that's good. What about? We talked a little bit about childhood, but do you have a favorite golf course?
You know, I had the opportunity to play Kiwa Island, the ocean course, twice, two different years. It's a long story how, but that's where the PGA Tour, PGA Championship is going to be in May. Yep. At Kiwa Island. And I play it twice, and I certainly didn't play, the tees are going to play, but it's so cool. I mean, literally, like three or four of the holes coming down the stretch, you literally could, turn your body to face the other way, and you could literally hit in the ocean. Like you could literally hit the ball in the ocean. You're that close to it, and the tee areas have sand blowing all over them, and we caddied up and all that. And then I didn't get to play it, but the last time the Masters was played, I was there. For that, and when Tiger won it, so that was obviously cool. Like it was hallowed grounds. I remember walking on. I was only there for the practice rounds, but it was really neat to be there. And now, for the rest of my life, I got the yardage book and the layout of the holes, and so I walked the course, and so now from here on out, I can actually know what the shots they're hitting and how it looks from the tee box, et cetera, et cetera. And so, I'm definitely into golf. That's kind of my hobby, and certainly you have more time to play it when you're a head coach than you do as an assistant. And then, during the pandemic, I think my wife thought I was trying to make the senior tour as much as I was saying I'm off in the day. But things have slowed down that way. And the problem with that is your handicap gets low, right? You play more, you get better, right? And I won't play much now until the next spring, and then I'll have the same handicap, and I'll get my butt whipped when we go back in the spring.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Obviously Augusta, every golfer dream right there. So that is for sure.
That's awesome.
We talked about it briefly, and keeping things obviously fair to everybody here. But do you have a Marty McCowan story that you can share with us or our listeners? What's your favorite memory or moment with Coach?
Gosh, I got some that I can't talk on air. We can talk afterwards. So Marty moved in across, he's kitty corner from me. He lived kitty corner from me. Like, it took 23 steps to go from my front door to his. Okay. So I was a sports nut, right? I'm 14. I'm going to be a freshman. And I was excited because we had a new coach, no disrespect to the last one, but they hadn't won there forever. And we got a new coach and he moved next door to me. So I literally grew up like across the street from the head basketball coach. And I used to babysit Brooks and John all the time. I would babysit them all the time. My dad and his crew took Marty under his wing, and which I'm not sure was good for Marty. But, you know, they got him, you know, getting up at the crack of dawn, going trout fishing. And, you know, here I am, you know, tagging along and trying to butter up the coach a little bit. I'm, you know, I'm babysitting his kids. I'm hanging out with him, trying to catch some fish. And, you know, I wanted to play, obviously. So I wanted to get a relationship with him. But, you know, we were integrated from day one. You know, we were integrated from day one. And then I don't know if he'll admit this, but like me and a couple of my buddies were hoops junkies, like Brent Brazzi, who's the head coach at Cornell Women's now and used to be on the men's side. He's a great guy and a great coach. And Kurt Lau, you know, who's passed away recently. We were really into ball. You know, it was more of a wrestling, football community, but we were into basketball. Like, we literally would, like, go over to watch Waterloo East play, just to watch them play. We talked about the trips to the parks, et cetera. But we were designing plays all the time. Like, we literally would come to coach, like, in study halls and practice and be like, hey, we need to run this, coach. We need – and he would let us. Like, we'd be in timeouts, and we'd be running the timeout. People would do triangles and twos. And I remember having Pepsi cups in the concession stand and laying them out saying, hey, we need to do this and that and this and – and credit to him, he didn't think he had all the answers. And certainly, you know, we didn't know what the hell we were doing either. We were 14, 15 years old. But we literally would be calling plays and putting stuff in. And I just don't think that's probably the norm for most programs across the country. But, you know, he, I'm sure he would admit this. I mean, it wasn't like he, you know, had a ton of basketball X and O acumen walking in the door. He came off the gridiron and the baseball field right into being a head coach at a high school. And I think they won four games. Freshmen weren't eligible my year. Like you know, arguably I would have played, not played, but freshmen were not eligible at Wapsie Valley my year. So only year in the history of the school that freshmen weren't eligible, which is a whole nother conversation. So I got to watch, and they were 4-16 my first year. And then I became a sophomore, and the guys that I were with that I mentioned, you know, we were really into ball, and we started winning some games. And then he's just taken the program and obviously took off with it. I couldn't have been more excited to follow them for their state championship run. I was a little disappointed because we were in Vegas for the conference tournament, and Marty and his wife, Marty, were going to come to Vegas as soon as they lost in their playoff run. Because they weren't having a great year. I mean, I don't know how many games they won. I think they won 17-8 or something like that. And they may have had 12 or 13 wins going into the playoffs. And they ended up being the 8th seed. And so he had a plane ticket, a hotel room. He was coming to Vegas to watch the WAC tournament. And they just went on this unbelievable run. And then his assistant, Mitchell Babers, is married to my niece. And he was coming too. And so, you know, our fan base dropped a little bit when they won the championship, even though it worked out great because they were allowed to play. And two, we didn't get to play. That would have really been bad if they got beat and then they come out there. They don't even get to watch a game. But, Marty's the best and couldn't have been more happy for him and his family to get that state championship under his resume. It certainly has got a ton of wins. And I just saw him, you know, I was back home this weekend, seeing my family, et cetera. And I went to the football game and spent a bunch of time with him on the sidelines, reminiscing, et cetera. And he still got the same upbeat personality he always had. So I was fortunate that he moved in when he did. And you know, we're certainly not coach player relationship anymore. It's developed way more than that.
No, that's good. We enjoyed our conversation with Marty, and he actually shared a lot of the same sentiment as you just mentioned. So that's good. Coach, two more and we'll get you out of here. One, Adam and I have the privilege to come down and watch your team play. Where do we got to stop and get a bite to eat before we come by the stadium? Where's the spot down there for us?
We got a bunch of them. Mexican food runs the show around here. Mm-hmm. It's authentic. When I first got here, they talked about, are you red or green? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, are you red or green chili? And I'm like, chili, where I come from, chili is hamburger, tomatoes, some broth, tomato sauce. And it's, you eat it on cold nights, Friday nights before the football game, et cetera. And they're looking at me like, that ain't chili. And, I was not familiar with it. But here, it's chili country. It's produced around here. It's processed around here. And they put it on everything. And red or green is, you want red or green, or do you want Christmas style, which is red and green? And they told me, and I wasn't a spicy food guy, and they told me, oh, you'll get used to it. You'll get used to it. I'm like, you're crazy, because this stuff, salsa's nothing. Chili's the deal. And so there are so many mom and pa Mexican restaurants around here, and they're unbelievably good. But if I had to choose one, I would send you to, getting to know you guys a little bit, I would send you to the Doghouse. Okay, it's called Andale's Doghouse. It's indoor, outdoor. You can bring your dogs, and they got some, the green chicken, the green chili chicken enchiladas is my favorite dish in town. And there's a lot of people that serve it, but that's probably my favorite right now.
That's awesome. Adam, make sure you get that on the list.
Got it.
And then last one here for you, Coach, and you've kind of mentioned it, a little bit of a loaded question, but opportunity for you to kind of share your feelings and a good one to send you out on. But tell us, what's the best thing about being the head coach for the New Mexico State Aggies?
I love being at a place where people care about ball. There's a rich tradition of winning here, from way back in the day. There's been some great coaches, some great players, some great teams. I love being at a place where literally the mood of some of the people of the city is affected by how we perform and how we do. And I love being a part of it. I don't take it lightly. It means the world to me. Aggie fans are worldwide. If I travel, ultimately someone, recognizes me, especially if I wear something Aggie, which I try not to, but they're everywhere and it's important to them. And I love the fact that, basketball is important to folks around here, not just on campus, but not even just in the community. It's people are proud of this institution and proud of this program. I'd never really been down here much in the Southwest, a few times recruiting maybe to play a game, but to live down in here, not only they love the Aggies, it's a golfing community. We got four great courses and they're all really good. You got the mountains and the desert, et cetera. So it makes for great setups. You can play year round. I love the weather. When you're winning, it makes it a lot more fun to be a part of the program. And we've been doing, some of that. So that makes it a lot more fun. But, our ceiling is, our goal is to, make a run in the tournament. We pretty much, for the most part, done everything else, with the Power Five wins, with the consecutive championships. We're in the midst of a 19-game winning streak. When we head into the season, we'll have one of the longest winning streaks in America, and that'll be a rallying cry for our program to try to extend it for as long as we can. Certainly it won't last forever. We got to unbelievable streak going on in the WAC as well. I don't even know what it is off the top of my head, but it's fun. And winning's fun. You guys know it. It certainly beats the hell out of losing. You just don't show me a lot of losing programs that are having a lot of fun. They're just not, from the head coach to the last guy on the bench. So it's fun to be a part of it. And you know, I think we can get better. You know, I think our name continues to resonate with young people, and we got a great sell with the winning and the weather and the tradition. And once people, you know, are more familiar with it, that's probably our biggest problem is, you know, they don't know exactly where we're located. You know, I didn't know a lot about the state of New Mexico until I moved here. And it's an awesome place to live. There's a ton of stuff to do in terms of, you know, hiking, fishing, hunting, the golf we talked about. There's a lot of stuff to sightsee in the state. And so it just couldn't have worked out any better. And we're definitely looking forward to the future.
That's great, Coach. We appreciate it. We really appreciate all your insight. Most importantly, we appreciate you taking some time and chatting with us today. We know you're a busy guy. I know we have the season's right around the corner here. And so, again, just thank you. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, great talking to some Iowa guys. Hope you guys are having fun with this. I'm sure it will continue to grow and we'll get some bigger, brighter names than me. And I'm sure you guys got some targets on some folks. If you need anyone and you need some help, you know, let me know. A bunch of Iowa guys out there that are doing great things in the world of basketball, and hopefully your fan base will continue to grow. But I enjoyed talking to a couple small town Iowa guys myself.
Awesome. Yeah, like Brian said, Coach, we really appreciate the time and appreciate our listeners as well. As we always say, you know, if you enjoyed what you hear, wherever you get your podcast, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating. And find us on every social network, Facebook, search The Shooter's Touch, Instagram and Twitter at Shooter's Touch IA. And always remember, shooters shoot. Cause I'm right in my mind, hustling harder than ever before. Saying I change cause I like when I shine. The diamonds hit different like Mike in his prime. I got the shooter's touch, yeah. Can't nobody ball like me. Blue face, hunters on hunters on hunters. That's really all I see. Ali Farouk Manesh, a name that will live in infamy for the NCAA tournament, for all Northern Iowa Panther fans, and in Kansas Jayhawk world as well. Ali is initially from Pullman, Washington, where he grew up playing basketball all the time. Him and his family moved to Iowa City, where he ended up going to Iowa City West, and initially was not tall enough, not athletic enough, not good enough to play a lot of minutes for that high school team. So Ali got to work. He improved what he needed to improve and ended up playing a lot of minutes for the really good Iowa City West team at the end of his high school career. After high school, he had no scholarship offers, chose Indian Hills where it didn't necessarily work out for him, so transferred to Kirkwood where he really made a name for himself, again, by putting in the work that he needed to. Ali talks about some great stories at Kirkwood, playing for Coach Wagemeister, and a couple of stories that really changed his mindset in practice and therefore in games as well. After Kirkwood, moved on to Northern Iowa, obviously, and played for Coach Jacobson. Again, tells some great stories about a couple games, about a couple aspects of playing for Coach Jacobson that really changed him as a player and changed those Panther teams that had a couple runs to the NCAA tournament there. After that, went overseas, played 3 or 4 years, ended up coming back and deciding to coach at Nebraska, and then moved on to Drake, where he was an assistant coach and now actually in Colorado State, the great state of Colorado, coaching under as an assistant coach, Nico Medved. Ali tells great stories, as I mentioned. He is a super intelligent coach who will be a head coach eventually whenever he decides to. But it was great connecting with him, as it is always great connecting with these coaches and connecting the dots with some of the aspects of my background playing at UNI and just after me when Ali made the trip there. We hope you enjoy this episode. As I mentioned, Ali Farouk Manesh.